Welcome to the Fundraising Leadership Podcast, where we talk about topics related to fundraising, leadership, coaching, and management. I'm Michelle Malloy-Dillon.
And I'm Janice Cunning. And Michelle, today we are excited to have two guests with us. We have Nika Allen, who's the founder of the Empathy Agency, and we have Scott Russell, who's CEO of Alzheimer's Society of Toronto. So welcome, Nika and Scott.
Thank you for having us.
Good. And Nika, you wrote a great blog post for us last week that we'll link to in the show notes called Identity Matters. And we are excited. This is a little bit of a different podcast because we're having you on as the author to unpack that. And then we've also invited Scott to join us. So why don't the two of you kind of tell us why you're both here together and what the connection is between you?
Yeah, thank you. Well, Scott's my good friend. We became friends over the last year, spending time together through coaching. Scott and his executive team were looking to do some additional work around equity. And through a mutual friend, Kathy Barrick, I was introduced to Scott, and we began to explore the work that we could do with his team.
Yeah, that sums it up really well. I think for us, the only thing I would add is why it was really important and how much I value the work we've done. And that's, my radar was up for an opportunity like this, driven mostly by our staff team that through our last strategic planning process identified the need to look at inclusivity in particular in terms of how we deliver service and how we operate as an organization. So when I heard that such a thing existed in terms of coaching and looking at some of these issues, I was excited to sign up. I met with Anika. I think we went to Fresh for lunch, and it was we were on the same page. We're both fundraisers, and we're both passionate about making a difference in the world, and this seemed like a good fit. So.
Off you went.
Yeah. Great. And give us a little bit, maybe you, Nika, can tell us a little bit, like what does that mean for people who might not be familiar with this kind of coaching?
Yes. So in the case of Alzheimer's Society of Toronto, we actually crafted specific training for their executive team. And so I'm saying we, so I must say I work with a wonderful partner by the name of Chris Conroy out of Boston. Our approach is that we come together to do this coaching, looking at sort of two sides of the same coin. So Chris is a white man, and he really spends the bulk of his time working with our clients on the deconstructing of whiteness, while I am working with the same team simultaneously, but separately, on the development of identity and how that relates to culture and how we work that out in our organizations, right, to achieve equity. And so we sort of start off together, all of us, then we break off and we do 12 weeks in tandem, and then we come back together at the end. And so that's what AST signed up for. And that really, entails, doing internal work. So I find myself, this is the thing I'm saying over and over again. We see a lot of people doing work around diversity and equity, and it's this external thing. And we want to be able to, well, what is a tangible thing that I can take away and do, right? Which is outside of yourself, when really this work is about addressing what's inside yourself. And that's true for all of us. And so that's why the coaching is set up the way that it is. It's why it happens over a course of 12 weeks. So it's 1 hour with me and 1 hour with Chris for 12 weeks. And that actually just gives our clients time to process a lot of really new information about who they are and how they show up in the world and how that relates to other people. What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, no, I'm smiling because you make it all sound really easy. It's really simple. We'll just do an hour with Chris, we'll do an hour with Anika, and bang, you can tick the box on inclusion.
So what didn't feel so simple about it for you, Scott?
So we hinted at this when we were talking pre-show, was about vulnerability. It's when you talk about doing inside work, it means admitting you don't know everything. It means admitting there's something that you have to question about who you are. It's deeply personal is where it starts. And you think, oh, well, it's sort of workplace. This is professional development, isn't it? Well, it is, but it's actually, you kind of got to get around in your own junk and sort of clean out the closet a little bit, look at stuff that you haven't looked at in a long time, check out some old diary entries and go, wow, who was that pimply-faced 14-year-old boy who thought he was going to be an actor, right? Like, there's stuff you have to, you do in this work that you don't even think. Like Anika says, we often tend to externalize these problems and make them something we can deal with outside of us, when in fact, it's really, it starts with you, right? That be the change you want to see in the world. And that's what this work is really about.
Yeah, and even that term identity, Nika, just that term, and as you talk about bringing the work into the inner self, both you and Scott are talking about that. And there is something about, wait, you mean I have to talk about my identity? I just work with these people, right? That automatically feels vulnerable and so personal.
It does. And you know, it's interesting because in the work that we do in nonprofits, and particularly as fundraisers in philanthropy, which is the love of people, right? Isn't it in this space that we should have room to be the most vulnerable? I mean, we are tasked with serving the vulnerable, right? So when we bring ourselves armored up into our work, we are doing a disservice both to ourselves, to our colleagues, to our beneficiaries.
Yeah, absolutely. That's beautiful. So there's so much I want to ask and I don't even know where to begin. This work is so important. This work is so important and so much is going on in the world right now around this work. I guess I want to ask, like, what's the most challenging part about bringing this work into organizations?
I think it's exactly what Scott just described. You know, people might not know at the outset that it is as difficult as you know, Scott has articulated, but they have a bit of a sense. You know, as soon as you start to say the work begins with you, this is internal work, that the work isn't one day, it's not a half a day, it's 12 weeks. It's actually two hours with us, right? Out of your week for 12 weeks. And then there's homework, there's work in between, right? So people sort of fundamentally know that this is going to shift things somehow. They don't know how, but they know that, you know, change is on the menu.
Which is exciting and scary at the same time, right? When change is on the menu.
Yes, and I think that we have an automatic response to change, right? Which is, I don't want to do that. Or we like to make excuses for why we don't have the time. Our executive team can't dedicate 12 weeks. We don't have the budget. You know, I'm not really sure that this is the route that we want to go. Oh, but maybe we should just first begin with, you know, this other sort of theoretical piece of work that makes us feel good, right? Makes us feel like we might be doing something similar to a lot of the statements we see organizations and companies making right now. You know, let's go write a statement. Mm-hmm. But let's not go write a statement and then back it up, right, by doing the work that you should be doing to become more equitable. I think that's the most difficult part.
Well, and Janice, I think intuitively, or I'm not sure, it may have been Michelle that mentioned this, but I think you, when you talk about having those awkward conversations at work that you got to bring a piece of yourself to, like, how do I even begin by saying, here's me, and then I know it's going to get awkward. We just run away from discomfort, right? It's much easier to hide behind a role. And I mean, just to put this out there, I know we'll get to the cultural pie exercise at one point, but one of the first things Anika had me do was this exercise. And when we debriefed on it afterwards, she said, well, would you share that with your staff team? I was like, no, I mean, I'm the CEO. I'm not going to tell them this stuff. And it was such an eye opener to say, yeah, no, there's actually so much of my job. I just automatically, I'm not trying to hide it, but I do. Mm-hmm. I hide behind a role. I hide behind a title. I hide behind the fact that I'm a white man. And there's a whole bunch of assumptions that come with that that actually advantage me, but I don't ever have to deal with them. Mm-hmm. I can do nothing. And it's all nice and comfortable for everyone. And we continue the dance around it. So I think that's what, when you talk about doing this work, you know it's going to get messy. And mm-hmm. Messy is something we tend to run away from, particularly at work.
And I'm kind of making an assumption, Scott, that at some point she convinced you to share it. Is that correct?
I share with everybody now. I start with that, and it's really cool because there are things that I'm willing to say, and it was an eye opener. I just said I'm a white man. I remember one of the first sessions we came out. I actually feel really uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
Because I'm colorblind. Mm-hmm. I treat everybody equal. You know, those were ingrained pieces of my identity. I'm a progressive, college educated Canadian. Mm-hmm. I could not possibly be culpable in a system of racism. Right. But of course, those are things that you buy into in your identity and go, well, geez, if I admit that I see color, well, then what?
Yes. Yeah.
If I admit, take the Harvard unconscious bias test. If I admit I have an unconscious bias towards Black people, what does that say about me?
Yeah.
I must be a horrible human being. And that's kind of at the heart of when you talk about white fragility, and like that's at the heart of it. We're really terrified to say there are things about us that we need to question and grow and learn from and evolve.
Yes, yeah.
But until we wade into that conversation, yikes. But yeah, now I like to throw out that I'm a white man, especially around with lots of other white people, because then all of a sudden the vibe changes. They go, ooh, what are we talking? He's not going to say the racism word. Where are we going with this?
Feel discomfort coming on.
Yes.
And this is the disruption that's necessary to move through these identities, these impacts that are happening.
Yeah. I must say, so I've been working through Me and White Supremacy, the book, in a group. What you said so struck me, Scott, because, I've taken so many things from that book, and I feel like as soon as you finish day 28, because it's a workbook, you have to start over because there's so many layers. But one thing that struck me so much is how much we get in the way when we want to be a good person.
Yeah.
Because we can't admit how we feel if that's like the identity, like I'm a good person. And that, I mean, the day I read that, I was just like, I will never be the same person again, you know? So I am curious, like, and maybe both of you could speak to this, like, Scott, maybe personally, like, what's been the impact for you and your team and the organization, and then Nika more broadly, like what kind of impacts do you see when people are actually willing to have these conversations and go within?
I think Scott could like take this all the way home. I'm happy to I'm happy to expand if there's any room to expand after Scott speaks, but I know Scott he's got something to say.
On a couple of different levels, I think this work is really fascinating. It's opened up conversations with me with people I've known for years that I never would have had around racism and the things that they've experienced and what that has meant in their life and what they struggle with. So and it's something, again, as a white person, I'm colored. I treated everybody equal. And here are people that are really close to me that I go, wow, I didn't realize that was a struggle. Mm. So it's a whole level of conversation on a personal level. But then when you talk about it organizationally, and this is where I've become this big believer in that, in this idea that diversity is strength. Mm-hmm. What we're doing within the organization now, and I continue to push this with our executive team, we'll be taking our frontline managers through the training with Anika and Chris as well. But what we've been doing organizationally is pushing this idea: we have to have difficult conversations. It's not just about racism; it's about the work that we do. We deal with people who are stigmatized because they have cognitive deficiencies, because they're elderly. Like there are some things that we deal with in it that it's very relevant. We need to have those difficult conversations. So it's having the courage to wade into those organizationally that's been the biggest blessing, I think, of the training, is to say, no, we have to do this. It's important. The starting point is around racism, but man, it changes everything. It changes how we work in teams. It changes how we view, we have to start to look at everything. How do we hire? What's the process of hiring? What's the thinking about strategy? What's the thinking about how we partner with other groups? And it means not just going where it's comfortable, but going where we need to go. Because as Anika said, we're charged with a responsibility to make a change. We're charged with a responsibility to serve people who are vulnerable. And sometimes that means we have to become vulnerable to get into that space.
Yeah, it's kind of like I see your work, Anika, as like, well, you are a coach, but it's like a workout partner. It's like, I'm gonna help you get more comfortable with going into very uncomfortable spaces. This is a muscle that has to be built.
That's so funny you say that, because Scott will know that is the exact analogy I use. I don't say I'm a workout partner, but I might start. But I do say we are developing a muscle here that you have never had to use. So what happens when you work out for the first time, right? Your muscles hurt, they're sore, right? All of those things. It's hard to move. It's like everything's uncomfortable. And that is a perfect analogy for this work, and which is the reason why we can't go in for one day, right, and then leave you a mess, right? Because that's what it is, right? But after the first session,
I was gonna say what happens after you work out and you haven't worked that muscle in a long time. I was gonna say you cry.
Yeah,
you cry a lot.
Yeah,
which I think that was certainly the leadership, our leadership team. That was our experience.
And, you know, we want to move, you know, our clients through, you know, the grief into, you know, healing and action, so that they can be more fulfilled as individuals. Certainly, because when we're more fulfilled as individuals, we come into our workplaces, right? And we contribute in better ways. And so the goal is to get, you know, all of the people on the team to begin to do this work, so that, you know, then when you go to do the external work, you're working it from the inside. Mm-hmm. You know, conflict, one space we spend a lot of time on is, you know, the nature of conflict. And conflict is inherent in our lives, yet we spend a lot of time trying to avoid it, as Scott just mentioned, right? And we're doing ourselves a disservice when every time we run from conflict. You know, I often say, I get a little bit excited when conflict brews. Not that I don't get nervous and I don't get some of the same feelings everybody else gets, but there is also this weird feeling I get of excitement, because I believe that if the other person in the conflict is committed to working through it, I know coming out on the other side is always better than where we began, right?
Yeah, a sign of conflict is like, okay, now we've got something to work with.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And truth will emerge. And, you know, the telling the truth, you know, about ourselves and how we are as leaders and how we are in our organizations is all really central to equity. Yeah.
That's what I loved. And I was sharing your blog again today, I think you shared it, and I was commenting, like, you just have to keep reading it. So I want people to read it, but reread it, because it's there's just so much in the links that, you know, that you make. And I love that it's like we can't like get to belonging if we're not willing to go inside and look at our own identity. Like, that's what I was most struck by.
That's exactly right. That is 100% right. You know, it's interesting. I think we can all think of times when we have entered an environment where we weren't sure, we didn't know the people, we weren't sure what was going on, but we knew we didn't belong. Right? We innately know these things. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I think it's really important that people who are responsible for creating environments where people spend the majority of their day, they're really responsible for creating environments that are equitable and that, you know, give room for people to show up in their multiple identities and contribute. I mean, we've not talked about, and we could spend a whole other hour talking about, you know, what is lost when we don't create those environments and when, you know, people can't come to work and contribute their whole selves, right? There's a tremendous loss to the organization. I mean, there's trauma that happens to the individuals, but there is a tremendous loss in addition to that, to the organization that no one's measuring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, there is so much to unpack. And we do, you know, one of the things we love on this podcast is to get real and like give people something that they can do, right? Like, or something to think about or something to do. So the two of you mentioned a sort of exercise called the cultural pie, I think is, yeah. And walk us through that and how people can use that.
Yeah, so this is one of the first exercises I do with my clients, and it's called the cultural pie. And what it is essentially is, you know, we want you to draw a pie on a piece of paper, and I want you to think through all the various things that make up your identity. And what we're going to ask the listeners to do in this exercise, because you won't have a coach with you, is to write down your identities, but exclude anything that refers to a professional title, and refer and eliminate being Canadian. So Canadian is a no-go.
And, or whatever your nationality.
Or you, or whatever your nationality.
Particularly Canadian, actually.
Yeah, no, I think Canadian's the one.
Canadian is the one.
I was going to say Torontonian.
Well, we're just, because we're just saying we have listeners. We have listeners in other countries, so. Well,
go ahead, Scott. I know it. Go ahead.
So this isn't intended to exclude. The point is, in our context, when you say, you know, we're saying exclude Canadianness, because one of the things that hopefully by doing this exclusion you will find in reflecting on it is that there is so much attached to your national identity that, like, when I say I'm Canadian, that's to distinguish me from an American. Mm-hmm. That's to distinguish me from a set of values that I think are distinct in some way. Canadians are X, Y, or Z, whatever that is. But that's actually not really a thing.
Yeah.
Like, in a sense. Yeah. So, you know, in the training, and you might have to come up with something new now, Anika, we've spoiled it, but in the training, like, honestly, you get a white guy like me, how often does he come in and 50% of his pie is Canadian? So.
Yes, the Canadian piece is a specific, saying too much, if we can avoid saying Canadian and avoid any professional titles, that would be ideal. And then once you have that, what you want to do is you want to assign them to the pie. So each identity needs to take up a percentage of the pie. So as an example, for instance, one of the largest segments of my pie are comprised of being a descendant of the Underground Railroad, being Black, and being a woman. Those are my top three that I think they made up about 70% of my pie. Everybody is different. There are no rules. The percentages are up to you, but it's an exercise to begin to actually start considering, who am I, right? Who am I without the titles? Who am I without national identity? Who am I?
I love this as a visual, as a visual person. I love this idea of actually putting what is in my head or what I haven't admitted is in my head on paper and being able to look at it from that objective viewpoint.
Yeah. I think just asking the question and, you know, having someone enter into the exercise is unique. I remember the first time I was asked to do the exercise years ago, and I would say I had a pretty clear sense of my identity, I thought, until I sat down to do it. And then I really had to think through, you know, what is my Blackness about? How do I, you know, how do I rate my gender? You know, at that point in my life, my daughter was an adult. Where does motherhood fit into that? You wrestle with yourself, mm-hmm. right? Around what is the priority or what are the priorities or what emerges to the forefront or what do I want to emerge to the forefront? Mm-hmm.
Could it be maybe two different pies? What emerges to the forefront and what do I want to emerge to the forefront? That would
it
be
totally could be two different. Yeah. And as you age and experience life, your pie should change. So, you know, mm-hmm. after the first time I did my cultural pie, you know, one of the parts of my identity that I wasn't really giving voice to and I wanted to was my Indigenous heritage. And although I had known about it, I really didn't emphasize it. And so, you know, now that's in my top three, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, this sort of thing can also change. I mean, as I said in the blog, you know, there are some inherent things about identity you can't change, right? But then there are also things about your identity, right? How you see yourself, how the world sees you, all of those things work into identity as well. And so this kind of gives you some autonomy over, and so you should have autonomy over your identity, right? Yes. Which is why I think the exercise is really pivotal and it's the place where I begin the work that I do.
And Scott, I'm curious, what impact did it have on you to go through that exercise?
So I think much of what we've already said has been covered. It gives you a bit of autonomy and it makes it, you have to then sort of mindfully select what's part of your identity. Hmm. What I found interesting, for example, not to harken back to this Canadian thing again, but the other thing I put into the pie, which when I saw it written down, I had to go, should it be there? Like why, like CEO, I think was one of them.
It was.
I like, is that? I mean, it's my job, but is that an immutable part of who I am? I mean, and absolutely not. I mean, for now, I hope it is, if my board is listening. that's not, that's like, it was pause afterwards to go, wait a second. Is that really about who I am? Or that's a role I have? And then there were pieces of it that I said, should that still be there? That's been there a long time. And I feel a little weird about taking it out, but I've been saying it's been a talk track. It's been my cocktail party banter for so long. Is that really it? So like Aniga said, there were parts that I went, I want, actually there's something there I want more people to see. Mm-hmm. That could be kind of surprising and different and might be a bit vulnerable for me to start sharing it, but it's true and I want to own it. So yeah, it is, again, it's like right back. It's vulnerable stuff. It starts with you and then it launches you into this whole area of you want to have these awkward conversations because they're transformative.
Yes. I think also, I love that you did harken back to the Canadian point. I think it's really important for the listeners to know that oftentimes clients do use Canadian in their cultural pie. And so then my question to them is, well, what is Canadian? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And then I get a litany of things that are, you know, associated with, you know, whiteness, but also associated with, you know, things that we've attached to being Canadian. And then I say to them, well, my family's been in North America for 450 years. Mm-hmm. We've been in Canada for almost 200 years. So what is Canadian?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So that's a part of the challenge around national identity, and because it can assume things that, you know, really don't speak to identity. Right.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a beautiful segue to sharing stories.
Yeah.
And somebody has a book coming out soon. So let's hear about that.
Yes. Oh, so exciting. So Collecting Courage, Joy, Pain, Freedom, Love. It's being published by Civil Sector Press. And it is, well, I refer to this as a testimony of my brother and sisters from the United States and from Canada. So it's a compilation of 15 first-person narratives, all Black fundraisers. And they're writing under those four themes that I just mentioned that are in the title. And I'm currently knee-deep in editing. I am one of the authors. I'm one of three editors. And we are working feverishly right now to complete the manuscript. But those stories are, they are challenging my language right now because they have exceeded my expectations. I'm actually not sure what I expected. I knew it would be great, but it exceeded that. And what I really love about what my brother and sisters have done is they have been tremendously vulnerable in sharing some of the most painful points in their career and in their lives. But they've also shared how out of that pain they have emerged. They're providing advice for other Black fundraisers who may be experiencing what they're experiencing. And ultimately, in the end, you know, we're talking about love. And I believe, based on our historical experience as Black people, we have a tremendous capacity for love. And I think that puts us in a very interesting position as it relates to the profession that we're in. Mm-hmm. And so we're really excited about the book launching November 23rd.
November 23rd. Okay, great.
23rd.
Right. When, where can people buy it, or do you know yet?
So I don't know yet.
Okay. Will you share with us when it is, comes out, we will share with our community?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I assume it will be in all of the common online spaces, but I don't know for sure. So yes, I will share with you, and yeah, certainly people can reach out to me and I can keep them up to date on where to get it when I know.
Yeah, yeah, can't wait to read it.
Yeah, we'll link to, for both of you, in the show notes to your LinkedIn so that people can reach out, learn more about your work, hear more, you know, about the impact for you, Scott, that it's had on your organization. So yeah, so thank you both. What a delight, you know, like to have the two of you and your lovely friendship and relationship at the forefront of this conversation.
Oh, yeah. My pleasure. I mean, I'll go anywhere with Scott. He's a great friend and a wonderful person. And I'm so glad to have had the opportunity to know him and to continue working with him. And thank you to both of you for being interested in the work that I'm doing and being interested in hearing, you know, Scott's voice on this as well.
Yeah, good work. Good work. Thank you so much for being here. So please subscribe if you haven't already to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. And if you're enjoying the show, please rate and review it so others can find us too. Now go put it into practice.